for the, I guess, the first time in 2.5 years, we'll go to somewhere besides Genesis. Through with that, begin a series that will be about 30 weeks long, just on the church. And thinking about this, I thought of the history of this church. I thought of the past history of my own Christian life, and I want to just share some things that have been going through my mind, and I think within our church body as well, perhaps different things. But this church is about 15 years old, I believe. Is that right? How many of you were, when you came here, I was not here? Stephen, Sharice, Nate, Don, is anybody over here? All right. I think I started coming to this church when it was like 6 months old or so. Don was probably here from the very get-go, and Stephen, Sharice close to that, perhaps. But a new church has, or at least this church, when it was fresh and new, had an opportunity that sometimes is lost. In fact, in most churches, it seems to be lost as the years go by. And that is an opportunity to just do things fresh, just to examine everything that the church does when it meets every Sunday morning. And if we don't want to do it that way, we throw it out. And as the longer a church goes on, the more difficult it is to change. Now, that's not good, I don't think, but I think it is a fact that tradition, which in some ways can be good, seems to set in, and a church gets in what we call a rut. You've all heard, I'm sure that it said the last 7 dying words of a church. We've never done it that way before. But when this church was fresh and new, we really didn't know kind of where we were at from week to week. You know, it's a non-denominational church, so people tend to try us out that come from every tangent you can imagine. And so the church kind of found its own course over the course of the years and evolved a little, changed a little, until it kind of became what it is today. But I have been asking myself this for the last year or so, I guess, and it's not about, well, I have been asking about the church, but I've been more asking it about me personally. And that is, am I in a rut? Can I do the things that I do every Sunday morning without a whole lot of thought, and you may never know the difference? I don't know. I kind of think I might could. And that's sad. I kind of think that I could go through the motions, and it may be a while before you would catch on. Maybe that has already happened. And I want you this morning, each of us, to ask ourselves that question, not just the people who would teach or preach, or not just the people who would be involved in leading the worship, but ask yourself that question as a Christian, whether your ministry is as a mother, a father, a teacher, someone that goes on mission trips, whatever it may be. Ask yourself, what is the take our pulse take your spiritual pulse and see just how healthy we are. And I hope that as we go through these next 30 weeks, that these sermons and these lessons that we will give on the church will be holding out before us symptoms of a healthy church that we might check our own pulse by. You know, there are times when certain things I can do to check my own well-being, physical well-being. And some of those things I tend to avoid because ignorance is bliss. Better not to know, right? Perhaps I could get my blood work done a little more regularly than I do. But part of the reason I put that off is because I know what the answer is going to be. I could check my blood pressure a little more often than I do, but why check it? And that's what I want these sermon series to be, is just something, some way in which we can check our pulse collectively as a church and individually as a person. Being in a rut is, in a way, it's comforting is probably not the right word, but it's easy. It's easy to follow this course that has been engraved or chiseled out, where you don't have to worry about the boundaries. You know, you just follow the rut and go on your way. But there is risk to be taken in getting out of the rut. And it's a risk you may end up in this ditch or in that ditch or take a wrong turn or whatever. But it's a risk that as a church and as individuals, we have to take. It's a healthy risk. Now, you've had an outline, perhaps you've seen one laying around there, that I'm going to go through. Now, this is going to be the outline that we will use as we go through these sermons. And I'm just going to go over the top of them this morning. I'm not going to go into any depth to any extent, but just to give you an idea of where we are headed. All right, to begin with, I want to read Ephesians chapter 4. If you would turn there, please. As I was reading this chapter, I thought maybe we should have just went through the book of Ephesians rather than came up with these topics. But I'll just read chapter 4, Ephesians chapter 4, verse 1. Paul says, "I, therefore, the prisoner of the Lord, beseech you that you walk worthy of the vocation wherewith you're called." Notice that. Paul says, I want you to walk in a worthy manner, doing that task that you've been called to do. Okay, do you see the application for the church? Walk worthy of the job that you have. Do it in a worthy manner, the job that God has called us to do. How do you do it? Verse 2, with all lowliness and meekness, with long-suffering, forbearing one another in love, endeavoring to keep the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. Now notice the next couple of verses. There is one body. He's talking about things that involve unity and harmony. There is one body and one Spirit, even as we are called in one hope of your calling, one Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father of all, who is above all and through all and in you all. But, here comes that word, but. Even though there is one body, one faith, one Lord, but. In verse 7. Unto every one of us is given grace according to the measure of the gift of Christ. He says there's one body. However, God works in different ways in each of our lives, and we'll see, to make up that one body. Verse 8, wherefore he saith, when he ascended up on high, he led captivity captive and gave gifts unto men. Now that he ascended, what is it but that he also descended first into the lower parts of the earth? He that descended is the same also that ascended up far above the heavens, that he might fill all things. Verse 11, and he gave some apostles, and some prophets, and some evangelists, and some pastors and teachers, for the perfecting of the saints, for the work of the ministry, for the edifying of the body of Christ. Verse 13, till we all come in the unity of the faith and of the knowledge of the Son of God unto a perfect man, unto the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ. Now, what he's simply saying is there is one body, but God in his wisdom has made up that one body and made it that it might be one body by giving all of its parts different abilities and different gifts and different measures of grace. That through these different abilities and gifts and utilizing them, the body might be edified. And the body might, being edified, do the work of the ministry. And it might do it until this oneness is taken place. Till we come in unity. We might serve one another and utilize and minister in our gifts until this one body becomes one. And he tells something that is pretty dramatic here in verse 13. We do it until we become a perfect man, till we become complete. We do it until we become the measure of the fullness of Christ. That's pretty exhaustive, isn't it? The fullness of Christ is what we are to become. Verse 14 gives me a contrast of what we are not to be. That we be henceforth no more children, tossed to and fro, carried about with every wind of doctrine, by the sleight of men and cunning craftiness, whereby they lay in wait to deceive. In so doing, we are able to avoid the isms that are all about us. That we're able to avoid the pitfalls of those who have other agendas. Verse 15, but speaking the truth in love may grow up into him in all things, which is the head, even Christ. And in verse 16, he gives a portrait of the church. From whom the whole body, fitly joined together and compacted by that which every joint supplieth, according to the effectual working in the measure of every part, maketh increase of the body unto the edifying of itself in love. Now, notice what that verse says. It says a lot there. By serving and doing our own, living according to our own giftedness, he says, from that, from this one body that is ministering in that way, the whole body fits together. Said in verse 16. And it becomes compact and becomes solid by that which every joint supplies, according to the effective working of each of its parts. And it grows up and becomes useful and edifying. All right? Now that's what our aim is. That's what our goal is. That as an individual and as God has placed us together in one another's lives, we might see that take place. But every once in a while, you need as an individual, and I need as an individual, and the elder board of this church needs as overseers of this body to take a pulse and to see how we're doing. And I hope that this series will be holding up to us a portrait of what a church ought to be like. Okay, let's look through and see what we'll be covering on the outline. We're just going to run through these very quickly. First of all, we're going to look at the church, its progenitor. That is, who created the church? Who made the church? Who started the church? Where has the church come from? It's a question of identity. We each have a name. Waldrop. Probably very few of you have ever thought very deeply about that name, Waldrop. But I've thought about it a lot. Nelson. I haven't given much thought to the name Nelson. Eric and Jill are the first people I've ever known by that name. I hadn't given it a lick of thought until a few years ago when they came here. But I haven't given it much thought, I'm sorry, since either. Why is that? Because it's not my name. What is our name? Christian. Christian. We'll examine in this sermon what it is. Who is our progenitor? What is our name? The next one, the church, its predecessor. And here we will look at an issue that in some circles is very important, and others perhaps not. But we'll ask the question, to what extent is the church, the New Testament church, the same as Old Testament Israel? Are they parallels? Are they perfect parallels? Can we learn some things about the church by looking at Old Testament Israel? To what extent are they equivalent? And ask ourselves, even in the Old Testament, were there types or were there pictures of the church that we can learn something from? Then the next one will be the church, its purpose. Its purpose, to glorify God. To glorify God. Seeing how it is that we can have that in the forefront of our mind in all that we endeavor to do. Then number four. Number four will consist of three sermons. The church, its portrait. There are at least six things in the Bible that are given, that the church is given as, or that are given as pictures of the church. The first one is, or one of those is, a bridegroom and his bride. Christ being the bridegroom, the church being a bride. We'll look at that portrait. We'll also look at the Christ being the head and the church being the body. We just saw an example of that in the text I read this morning, Ephesians 4. We'll look at, in another sermon, Christ being the vine and the church being branches of the vine. Christ being the shepherd and the church being sheep. Then in the third sermon, we will look at Christ being the high priest and we being a kingdom of priests. And Christ being the cornerstone and the church being living stones. Each of these portraits has a very vivid picture to paint for us that can help us value who we are as the church. Number five, the church, its practice. And here we'll have, I think it's eight sermons. Each one of these will comprise one sermon. The first one is the government of the church. What does the Bible have to say about the government of the church? It might, on the one hand, it might surprise us how little the Bible does say. And on the other hand, it might surprise us how much it says, at least about what it does say. Second will be about the nurture and the growth of the church. And here we're not talking about growth in width. We're not talking about going from 30 people to 300 people. We're talking about going from new Christians to deep Christians, to mature Christians. We're talking about the nurture and growing in depth of the church. Someone, I always remember this illustration, I probably told it to you before. Charles Haddon Spurgeon, in his early 20s, was preaching to thousands of people at Metropolitan Tabernacle. And there were a lot of preachers. Preachers then were just like preachers today. There are a lot of preachers who, in a way, were envious. and were jealous and wanting to know Charles Spurgeon's secret. How is it that your church can be so big and grow so fast and so many people come to hear you preach? They wanted the same thing, wanted to know his secret. And I remember hearing it said of Spurgeon that Spurgeon answered one of these persons in this way. He said, "Your concern is best given not to the pews that are empty, but to the ones who are filled." In other words, don't worry about the people who aren't there. Worry about those who are. And perhaps that was the secret as well. Third sermon on spiritual gifts. Now, obviously, that could be one that could be split into four or five sermons, but we're going to shape it up into one. I'm not sure who has that one, but we'll see. The next one, the Lord's Supper. The next one, baptism. Those two, the ordinances that we practice. A sermon on worship. And there, not just what worship is, but this is under its practice. How is it that we practice worship? A sermon on the discipline of the church. And a sermon on outreach, ministries, and missions. Then we go to number six, the church, its passion. To love God, to know Him, and to make Him known. The passion of the church. When I think of spiritual passion, even in my own life, and I can go look back over the course of my own Christian life, and if I were to gauge, or put on perhaps a graph, times where my spiritual passion for God was high and sometimes when it was low, I think I could at least in my own mind, pretty accurately give you this graph and show periods of time where it seemed like my zeal was very strong toward God. And sometimes there were times, perhaps even years, where my zeal might have been tapering off. And perhaps something would happen or something would take place and my zeal would get stronger, my passion would be stronger and go down. Why is it that fluctuates so? We may look at some of that. But a passion to know Jesus Christ. Then number seven, we look at the parables. Now this is an interesting topic here. There are, I don't forget how many there are here, 15 or 13 or something, parables. And here what I did was went back through the New Testament and looked through all the Gospels and found those places where the Scriptures say Jesus spake a parable unto them. Two things I looked for. One was where Jesus said, I speak a parable unto you. So we look at that parable. Or if times where Jesus said, the kingdom of heaven is like unto. And he tells a story there, a parable there. Illustrating something about the kingdom of heaven. And almost always, when we're preaching through the Gospels, the application of those things, we make the application to the church. So the question that we ask ourselves is that a valid application? And I think the vast majority of the time it is. Well, if it is a valid application, then that's why we're including it in this study. Because Jesus said, here is what the kingdom of heaven is like. And he gives us a parable, tells us a story, and the parables make one point. It's not good biblical hermeneutics to take a parable and to dissect it and try to make each point represent something. You can get off in la-la land in a hurry trying to do that. And the person next to you may do the same thing and be off in another La La Land, totally different than yours. The point is to see what one point Jesus is making with the parable, and to limit yourself to that one point. We've grouped these parables. You'll see Sermon 1, we'll take two of the parables, the parable of the sower and the parable of the barren fig tree. Sermon 2, we'll study the parable of the wheat and the tares and the parable of the large net. Sermon 3, parable of the buried treasure and the pearl of great price. That's actually two parables there. And the parable of the lost sheep. Parable 4, just one, the parable of the laborers. Or did I say parable 4? Sermon 4. Then Sermon 5, the parable of the two sons, the parable of the tenants, and the parable of the Pharisee and the tax collector. Sermon number 6, the parable of the mustard seed, the parable of the yeast, the parable of things new and old. Number 7, the parable of the wedding banquet, and the parable of the talents. And Sermon 8, the parable of the fig tree, the parable of the 10 virgins. Then number 8, the church, its propagation. And that is its width. How is it that the church expands itself? How is it that the church goes beyond these doors? We'll look at two issues there, two different sermons, one on evangelism and one on disciple making. We think of the Great Commission as a commission to evangelize the world. But the Great Commission is not an evangelistic commission. The Great Commission is a commission to make disciples, not evangelize, to make disciples of those who have already been evangelized. Let's look at the difference between those two things under that heading. Number 9, the church, its piety. Two different aspects of the same thing here. One, the calling to sanctification. That's the work of God, the work in which God sanctifies and sets apart something for a particular purpose, something for a particular reason. In all of our lives, we have things that we have sanctified. There are places in my house that I have sanctified where I put my shoes. And there are places in my house where Susan has sanctified that I don't put my shoes. But it's a place where we have set apart, or something that we have set apart and we have purposed. And perhaps it's not a very serious thing as putting, I mean, that's not, putting where you put your shoes, not a serious matter. But it's something that we have decided, here is what I'm going to do, or here is how this is going to be used. This is why I'm getting this. This is why I am doing that. And God has done that same thing with us. God has looked at you as His child, and He has set you apart from all that is common. You are different. The calling that God has made to set you apart, sanctification, sanctified and holy, its opposite is that which is common or mundane that everyone has. God has set you apart in a different way. That's God, the work of God. But then there is, the other side of that coin is our own efforts in becoming holy and becoming righteous. We'll see those two things under the piety of the church. And then number 10. Number 10, the church, its philosophy. Now this one will be, this will sound awful. this will be the one that will probably use our Bibles the least. Doesn't that sound awful? Because this is going to be an application of principles. How is it that the church, we look at doing church? See, a question I've got there. Is the church an organization, or is the church an organism? And your mindset of how you look at the church in regard to those words plays itself out in how you do church. Methodology, the methods that we may use. And here we'll see where sometimes where tradition can kind of get in the way and we can stumble over tradition. Because our methods ought to be open to change. But principles don't. So we practice and we do church according to principle, not according to methods. If you look at the history of the church, I think what you will see is that the church has been slow to pick up on new things, because new things are sometimes sinful, or at least portrayed that way. But then the church grabs hold of something. I'll give you an example. I'm not belittling this method, okay? I'm just saying this is an example. When I was a teenager, it was the big thing for churches to have bus ministries. Anyone ever either work on a church bus route or carried to church on a church bus? Okay? Churches had bus ministries. And that was deemed an effective way to reach unchurched kids. Okay? I don't have a problem with that. That was just used. But very soon, that method became unbendable, unshakable. And a church's maturity and a church's spirituality was gauged not by how they walked with Christ, but by how many church buses they had. I know. I've seen it, been there. A method that becomes unbendable and unmovable. What is the philosophy of this church? Some of that, we're gonna try to spell some of those things out. Why is it that we do certain things? Why is it that we tend to avoid certain things? We're going to try to spell some of those things out and see the reasoning behind some of those. And then the last one, the church, its preservation. Is the church a fad? Is the church just another ism that has come along and someday may run its course and be gone? Think of Jim Jones. Of course, that kind of ism can be gone in a hurry, the way that played itself out, right? But there are some groups, there are some cults, there are some philosophies that tend to be popular for a while, and then they tend to fade away and to just disappear. How many of you know what the Rosicrucians are? I haven't heard anything about the Rosicrucians in 15 or 20 years. I'm sure they're still around. But back in the 60s, I think it was a popular cultic type group that seems to be gone the way of others. We could name others, but what about the church? The church has bent and been blown to and fro and this way and that way, but the church is still here. Not just for the last 100 years, but for the last 2,000 years. The church has endured. Why is that? It's because God, very simply, has been undergirding it. It's because God has preserved it. We'll talk about that as well. I want us to have, and this is where we have just a different time, but I want us to have a time of prayer. We've had prayer sessions kind of in the middle of a service before where we kind of offered up short sentences of prayer here and there. We're going to open it up like that, but feel free to make them a little longer, not 30 minutes long, so somebody else can pray. But I'm not going to suggest things, but I want you to, the Lord just to lay on your heart what to pray about. Different aspects of this church, and different aspects of the church, how as it touches your life, and how it touches all of our lives, and just open it up for us all to just pray to God that we might have a fruitful time in this study, and then Tony will close it after a while.